Maybe we're channeling a little bit of Baptist presence here today. Running a little late, so relax. Settle in. When you think of Martin Luther King Jr., what's the first thing that comes to mind? Prophet? Civil rights leader? Black man? Scholar? Preacher? Father? Son? Christian? American? Citizen of the world? The truth is, he was all of those things, and likely many I have left out. He carried, as we all do, many different identities, all rolled into one remarkable man. I wonder which one would have been his primary identity of choice. I wonder if one of the things I mentioned stands out to any of you more than another. I played a game a number of times at group events where I invite the participants to take 4 or 5 index cards and write on each one a response to various identities, recognizing that many identities are fluid and socially constructed. But for the sake of the game, how would you, for example, identify your gender? How would you identify your race? Your nationality? Your sexual orientation? Your religion? And while you're doing this, imagine what groups of people or affiliations you are a part of as a result of these various identities. Who are your friends? And how are you most alike? And now imagine for the sake of the whole, you have to give one of those up, one of your 4 or 5 identities. Which one would be the first to go? Does it matter more to you that you are a woman or that you are American? Does it matter more that you are gay or that you are a Unitarian Universalist? So now you have 3 or 4 identities left, and of course the game is to whittle it down until you have just one identity. Which one for you is the single most important aspect of who you are? And how does that impact how you structure your life? What relationships would be at risk by giving up any one of the other 4 or 5 identities? Now that you've got that in your mind, hold on to it. Put it over here for a moment. Peace activist Carol Bragg worked much of 2014 as a member of a team tasked with digitizing Dr. King's papers for web display. And as a result, she had the opportunity to review a significant amount of his writings and references the one we heard excerpts from this morning, Dr. King's World House speech. King worked nearly a month on the lecture, she said, and later gave it prominence as the concluding chapter of a book describing the enormous challenges facing humanity. He may well have regarded the World House as his most important single speech or essay. Unlike King's I Have a Dream speech or Letters from the Birmingham Jail, she says, this work is virtually unknown. And yet it speaks to the global maladies that even today plague us, and just as Bragg suggested, that it was worth revisiting after the September 11th tragedies in 2001, it continues to point towards the many of the issues that underwrite our current and continuing global maladies, what King called the triple evils of racism, poverty, and militarism. In writing the World House speech, King moved beyond the specifics of the civil rights cause, beyond domestic racial inequality, and took on the world's social justice ills. However deeply American Negroes are caught in the struggle to be at last at home in our homeland of the United States, he said, we cannot ignore the larger World House in which we are also dwellers. Equality with whites will not solve the problems of either whites or Negroes if it means equality in a world society stricken by poverty and in a universe doomed to extinction by war, he said. It's worth noting, I think, that 50 years ago, the issue of climate change was not yet a headline as a threat to life as we know it. Nuclear annihilation felt much more an imminent threat during the Cold War era. I hope each of you will take the time to read this speech in its entirety. You will note that it is situated in a different point of political history, obviously, where he's concerned about communism versus democracy, for example. But Bragg suggests where Kim speaks of addressing the conditions that breed communism, we might today substitute terrorism or religious fanaticism. He's not at all gender inclusive, as Madeline pointed out, and his use of the term Negro does not ring consistent with contemporary language. It's also important to note that his focus on the big picture, however, does not negate the need to address the specific issues. Racial equality was no less important simply because he broadened his focus. In the contemporary context, the Black Lives Matter initiative is not less important a justice issue because all lives matter. It is a critical justice issue in and of itself. Yet 50 years later, the relevance of the World House with global issues remains as we continue to struggle with the very things that King identified as being problematic, and we've managed as a society, not to mention as a world, to avoid the spiritual and moral reawakening that he suggested would be required in order to turn things around. Many of us, many of you, make good and important moral choices every day and work hard for what we trust will have good effect. But it's clear we are still waiting in the collective sense for the revolution of values, for becoming a person-oriented society instead of a thing-oriented one, where people are more important than machines and computers, profit motives and property rights, where we maximize the internal life and minimize the external one. Why is that? What is taking us so very long? Two things come to mind for me. I'm sure there are more. One is resources. Whenever things get scarce, or whenever we begin to feel like they're scarce, even if they are not necessarily, the stakes go up and tensions rise. Power becomes an issue. This is slowing us down. The world feels smaller. Everything feels in less supply. And second, I don't think we've figured out the balance between what is me and what is not me. My needs versus the needs of those around me, between my people and everyone else who are not my people. A friend of mine used to interrupt conversations now and then by saying, "Okay, enough about that. Let's talk about my needs, my goals." It stopped everything. Every nation, King said, and by that he included tribe, race, class, and religion, must now develop an overriding loyalty to humankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. We haven't figured out how to do that yet. In fact, in some ways, it feels as though we focus more than ever these days on the beauty of the tribe, on lifting up particular identities, leaving humankind as a whole struggling. Of course, that may be easy for me to say as a white, healthy, cisgendered, housed, middle-class woman in the United States, right? If my identity were something that caused me more struggle, I might feel differently. Let's go back to the exercise from earlier in the sermon. Remember what you were thinking. What was the identity that remained the most important to you? Now imagine being asked to make that secondary to the common good, or to somehow compromise it, if only in a small way, a priority of being way. Could you do it? Or could you at least communicate about it in a way that others might understand and make room for? And could you listen well enough to those around you to do the same? Our older children are learning about the Tower of Babel this morning, not coincidentally. You may remember that story from the book of Genesis about humanity building a tower to reach the heavens and how they got higher and higher and the gods looked down and said, no, you are too powerful as one people. Babel was destroyed and the people were spread across the land, no longer speaking the same language. They are no longer one people. They no longer have the same priorities. They no longer understand each other. In the annotation to that biblical story, Michael Coogan includes the following: the scattering of humanity and confusing of language is the final step in the creation of civilized humanity with its multiple territorial and linguistic groups. The name Babel, interpreted here as confusion, serves as a final testimony to the ambiguous results of this process. This story likely came from mythology before that predated it and was an effort to understand life as it existed. How do we come to this place of speaking so many different things, of not understanding each other? Yes, ambiguous results. The scattering of humanity and confusing of language is the final step of creation of civilized humanity. And in this civilized humanity, we can't understand each other. I encourage us not to be too literal about the word language here, the scattering of languages. Let's broaden that construct to include groups of people who hear each other because they identify with each other. So it's not just about what literal language do we speak. I hear you because we have something in common. We have similar identities. We don't have to explain ourselves constantly because we speak the same language. I understand you because I know you and we believe similar things about life. Draw up that personal identity again. If a major part of your identity is being a woman, then when you are with a group of women, it's likely that relative to women's issues, at least, you don't have to explain yourself, right? We can be together around a common construct, men, for example. And oh my goodness, no, we know how good that feels, right? Or with a group of gay or lesbian or trans friends. It's just simpler. They get it already, whatever it is. If you're American, you don't have to explain what that means the way you would to somebody from Uzbekistan or Thailand. Whatever identity you've chosen in your mind and your heart, those are your people. They get you, and you get them. And if there were enough elbow room to move around, if we could each have our own Tower of Babel to the heavens, that might be okay. But of course, there isn't. There really never has been. Nor would we necessarily want to be so isolated from each other. We know how much beauty there is in difference. And now, of course, our house, our world house, is smaller than ever. And it appears we don't want to give up the comfort zones, however, of our particulars. Those things are what make us individually who we are, right? So I occasionally sign up for e-courses with an organization called Spirituality and Practice. And this month I'm taking one on holy silence. The leader is a Quaker elder named J. Brent Bill. He identifies as a Christian, so that his writing references God and Jesus often. He encourages those of us who come from different theologies or different traditions, those of us who speak different languages, if you will, to do what he calls listen in tongues. I want my words and thoughts to be helpful, he says. So if you come across something I've said that jars you because of my particular use of Christian language, please translate it into your own, more helpful language. listen in tongues, the antidote maybe to the Tower of Babel, the scattering, the confusion. Listen with an ear towards translating into another's reality, not just the specifics of the language, but of the lived experience of the other. Listening not just for the obvious differences in speech, but the subtle and sometimes not so subtle nuanced differences that would help us understand each other's needs and realities, that by understanding would help us find common ground. And here's the rub. This is a bigger challenge, that listening, I think, for those of us with majority identities, with identities that don't require adapting so much because they constitute the norm. The hubris of the majority, with the unconscious inattention to our privilege, makes us deaf to the other. When King says, "Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole," I suspect the ones that need to hear and to be listening the hardest, to be listening in tongues, may be the ones that think they already do. There's a great poem by UU minister Gordon McKeeman, or one that he offered: "Sometimes, when I note the utter stupidity of my fellow men, hear and see them lie, cheat, and wrangle, I fold my wings and adjust my halo at a little better angle." King reminds us the Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. So what are we failing to hear? We're failing to hear each other, apparently. On a global scale, on a national scale, we're failing to hear the same thing that we need to hear on a personal scale. We know this, that others' needs have needs different from our own, that what serves us, doesn't necessarily serve everyone, that there are undoubtedly more equitable ways of living, more inclusive, more generous, more thoughtful. This call for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation is in reality a call for an all-embracing and unconditional love for all beings. But there's a chicken and egg thing here. We can't love until we listen, and we don't listen unless our intention is to love. The large house in which we live demands that we transform this worldwide neighborhood into a worldwide brother and sisterhood. Together, we must learn to live as brothers, he said. Let's include our sisters, or together we will be forced to perish as fools. We can do better. As always, it's up to each of us to start practicing. So let's get busy. Let's listen. Let's listen, as the Quakers say, in tongues, willing to stretch our ears to hear the needs of the other, listening especially for the things we don't understand, that are foreign to our own identities, to our own sense of self, willing to have our overriding loyalty be to the whole. May we be inspired by King, preacher, father, civil rights leader, and prophet, to try to bend that arc of the universe that our own Parker spoke about just a little faster toward justice. And just when we're thinking to ourselves, I may not be the one who has to live and listen better, think again and listen harder. The World House needs us to do just that. So may it be, and amen.